It's blazing hot outside. You get in your car to turn on the AC to get cold air pumping, but it blows hot air out. This issue is commonly caused by low refrigerant due to leaks in the AC system. You want an easy, all-in-one solution that will restore the cold air in no time. AC Pro Recharge Kits make restoring cold air easy for even those with zero DIY experience in less than 10 minutes. Save time and money versus going to a shop by picking up an AC Pro Recharge Kit today. Be a pro with AC Pro.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Open Concessions podcast presented by Toyota, which features a weekly in-depth conversation with a Chicago Cubs-related personality. We are your hosts, along with Jim Deshaies. I am Len Casper. We make up the Cubs television crew. Belated happy Father's Day, JD, and a belated happy 60th birthday. Man, it's a big week for you.
It is a big week, Len, and we've come up with a little bridge celebration to the day in between Father's Day and my birthday. It's a, for he's a jolly good person, holiday. So we're celebrating around the clock here. It's been a lollapalooza of me.
Great, and we should have baseball back here at some point in July. We are looking forward to that. More on that later. Today's guest is former Cubs pitcher Kerry Wood. He struck out 20 as a rookie against the Houston Astros in 1998. He was the National League Rookie of the Year that year, a two-time All-Star. JD, he is a native Texan, but he has made his home here in Chicago with his family and one of the better guys around.
Yeah, beloved by Cub fans. Makes his home here, as you mentioned, does a lot of great work in the community, pitched arguably the most dominant game in baseball history. And the other thing about Kerry Wood, too, I think, you know, if people Google Kerry Wood, they don't know his story. You know, one of the words that pops up is disappointing, you know, in regards to his career, because he didn't end up having the Hall of Fame career due to all the injuries. But he had a really good major league career. You mentioned a couple All-Star appearances, the Rookie of the Year. Of course, we play the what could have been story when we talk about Kerry Wood, but what was really good.
Yeah, 14 years in the majors, not only the 86 wins, but 63 saves as later he became a closer. So without further ado, enjoy our conversation with Kerry Wood. Woody, thanks for joining us. How are you today?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me, guys.
You've been retired for a while, but it has to feel weird not being able to go to the ballpark.
Yeah, it's definitely a weird time. You know, not just sports related, obviously, with what's going on in the world, but to not even be able to flip a game on TV and hear you guys describing it for us and watching it. So it's definitely a weird time.
How are you and the family holding up?
We're good. Listen, we can't complain. We've got, you know, we've got some space here. We've got a yard, and you know, we've had lots of family dinners, and actually every night family dinners and family lunches and all that stuff. So we've had some good quality time and some great conversation. But I really feel for the people in the big cities. They're in, you know, studio apartments or not, you know, in a building with, you know, 500 other people and you know, what they'd been going through. So I can't complain at all.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, the silver lining is a lot of quality family time, but as much as I know I'm going to enjoy the next 45 minutes chatting with you, it'd be a lot more fun in person. That's what I actually miss about the ballpark is it really hits home how many conversations you have and how that dominates your day before, during, and after a ball game.
Yeah, right. I mean, even just coming into the yard, the ushers and the security people and conversations you're used to having every day, I'm sure that's quite a change. You know, my son has been playing some baseball, and they actually started up this past weekend. So we, not here in Illinois, we had to go to Wisconsin, where it's guns ablaze and there all systems go. But it still was weird being around people and being out. And but it was definitely nice to you know, on Father's Day to get out there and have a chance to watch the kids play.
Anything that brings us a sense of normalcy, right? Anything that kind of feels like, yeah, this is what it used to feel like.
Yeah, I never felt so good to sit out in 92 degree heat in the sun with no shade.
Well, we're going to bounce around a little bit today, but you last pitched in the big leagues in a very memorable final game as a Cub in 2012. You have remained incredibly productive in retirement. You and your wife, Sarah, have done amazing work for various charities. As you said, you're a family man as well. As you retired and you looked ahead to the next 8 to 10 years, what goals did you set for yourself? And do you feel like you accomplished those?
That's a great question. You know, the retirement kind of happened quickly. The shoulder was kind of, I could tell the shoulder was going to go. And, you know, I definitely didn't want to go back on the DL again and end my career on the training table. So, you know, it was kind of a quick decision. I didn't have time or didn't even think about the next 8 to 10 years. So, you know, when retirement happened and, you know, the next day you guys are all, everybody's still playing games and I'm at home. It was, you know, it was fine. I was ready to go for sure. And I was good with the decision, but that conversation never came up with the wife and I and the family about, you know, what the next 10 years are going to look like. So really just wanted to enjoy the kids and be around. And I knew I wanted to coach my son and got a chance to do that for 4 or 5 years and just, you know, loved that and had so much fun traveling around playing baseball and got to take him and do the 12-year-old Cooperstown trip. And, you know, I was a coach sleeping in the bunk with the 12-year-olds and trying to keep them under control and doing laundry and breakfast, lunch, and dinner. And, you know, as I look back on those memories, it's I was so glad I had the opportunity and the time to be able to go do those things. You know, and travel. We did a lot of traveling. We didn't sit still for, you know, 5 or 6 years and just kept kind of moving around and going and seeing the world, going and seeing our country and other countries. And the kids have really enjoyed doing that as well. So, you know, and then I got a chance to coach my daughter's basketball team for a few years and get to know all her friends. And it's really been family focused and you know, traveling around and seeing the world and really enjoying the time that I always heard older teammates say that, man, I wish I had more time. Or guys always retire because they say, I want to spend time with the family. And then they're out playing golf 5 or 6 days a week. And I'm like, well, how much time are you really spending with the family if you're at the golf course all the time? So I tried the golf thing and I'm terrible. So I limit that to maybe once a week. But I just really, really am focused on and enjoying the family and traveling and seeing the world and being a part of their lives as much as I can. And then obviously the foundation has taken up some time and foundation is doing great. So we've made big strides in the foundation as well.
So I have two questions based on your answer. One, you mentioned you felt your shoulder starting to go because I was curious and I looked at FanGraphs and you were still throwing 94 miles per hour. You were 34 years old. So just looking at those numbers, one could say, man, there was plenty left in the tank, but your shoulder obviously was barking. You'd had so many stints on the DL, so many injuries. So I can imagine you knew your body so well, you knew it was going to blow out on you.
Yeah. You know, that spring training, it was a weird spring training for me. I felt good coming in and started playing catch and throwing bullpens and I'm like, something's not right. And so I don't know if you guys remember now, we pushed off my outings, you know, for a couple of weeks and I was just doing stuff on the backfield, just trying to figure out what was going on and get it right and do a lot of treatment on it. And I think I only had 2 or 3 innings in spring training that year and you know, deemed myself ready to go and got off to a really bad start and still didn't feel great and wasn't recovering. And you know, it really just got to the point where I was handcuffing our manager, Dale Swain. I was just handcuffing him. If I pitched on a Tuesday, I wasn't available again until Friday or Saturday. I just couldn't recover. And so we tried to get through it and we tried to figure out what was going on and figure it out. And it never came around. So I really, really felt like I wasn't doing the team of any good service, more of a disservice than anything and really, really handcuffing him. So it just got to the point when I did finally recover after 4 or 5 days of my previous side. And I said, hey, I think this next one's going to have to be it, you know, give the next guy in line a shot.
And my other question based on your previous response, totally unrelated. So you're coaching your daughter in hoops. Were you a pacing up and down the sideline guy, a chewing on a towel guy? What was your vibe over there?
No, I stayed seated. It was house league. It was pretty tame. Definitely barking the entire game, you know, because they're 12, 10 years old at the time. And, and just for 10 and 11 and trying to remind them where they're supposed to be. They all want to guard the ball, and you know, there's four girls underneath the basket that are wide open, and they're all guarding the point guard. So just barking at them and reminding them that they've got somebody to guard and stay with them, and you know, trying to convince them that we've worked on an inbounds play for the last 6 weeks in practice. Let's try to see if we can run it one time during the season and do it correctly. So it was fun.
Yeah, I did that. I coached my daughters down in Texas in Y basketball, and yeah, I was stressed out, man. They were just little kids, but you got so invested in. And there was always that, you know, ours was kind of like a house league too. And you wanted that little kid that never touched the ball to score a basket, or, you know, one of those moments that's all that really mattered. You know,
yeah.
Winning and losing was obviously secondary. But if the little kid that had no clue, you know, with the glasses sliding down off the end of her nose, and
oh yeah,
if she managed to score, it's like the whole place went bonkers.
Everybody's got those on their team, and it was fun. And we actually, it was a really cool league that the referees were all local guys too, and older guys, and they get it. They've been doing it for years. So, you know, if it was, even if it wasn't a blowout, sometimes it was a close game. They'd come over to the bench and say, "Hey, does anybody need to score?" And then he'd call like a phantom foul on somebody that was off the ball. And then they'd get a couple free throws. They'd get a couple chances to put one in the hoop. So it was a great league. Great time.
That's great.
Well, you clearly are well adjusted, and as you said, it's difficult for some guys when all of a sudden they're 34, 35, and they're looking at the rest of their life, and they're not quite sure what they want to do. And you know, I'm so happy for Mark Pryor, who's now the pitching coach for the Dodgers. I get a chance to see him a couple times a year, and I often think of the pressure cooker you guys were in, you know, 02, 03, and that 03 team, such a good club. But being a Cub is not always easy, and I'm sure you can tell some of the younger players that, you know, when the pressure ratchets up, you really have to be good on the big stage. So when you think of, you know, those days in particular, and you and Mark in particular, because of the spotlight that was on you guys, what are the first few thoughts that come to mind?
Wow. Well, first thought is how the young guys of 2016 pulled it off, right? I mean, mm-hmm. that was impressive to me, because coming down, like you said, the stress of and the pressure of being in a big market and being in Chicago and dealing with the media and the expectations of, you know, on top of all that, the expectations of not winning in over 100 years, and then you get a good team together. We started hearing the buzz in, you know, July, and you know, and you don't really feel it until you get into September, and then it starts to be like, okay, well, we've answered all these questions. What is there still possibly to talk about? We just want to go out and you know, try to win some more games and get to the end and get to the postseason and go for it. But it is, I mean, it's a constant conversation. It's a daily conversation. You know, you just want to get to the yard and do your work in the gym and get out and do your long toss throw and keep your program going. You know, and meanwhile, you've got, you know, 30 or 40 media outlets out there that are wanting to talk to you or to chat with you and do their job as well, right? So there's a bunch of people that have obligations to do their job, but the hardest thing was just, I think, probably just the schedule of trying to figure out when you can, without blowing everybody off, keeping your work in, staying focused, and then, you know, trying to still talk about it, which was the hardest part. So that's, for me, that's what was so impressive about the 2016 team. I think they all handled it from top to bottom, you know, incredibly well with the media. And you never felt like, even when they had stretches where they didn't play well, you never really felt like there was stress in that clubhouse. And obviously, I think that's the key. And that comes from, the, you know, Joe Maddon from the top down, and just, you know, embrace the pressure. Right. And he had a couple of good phrases that he used to use. And, you know, the one that I liked the best was don't let the pressure outweigh the pleasure. And, you know, those guys definitely didn't do that.
Well, and you had a tiny clubhouse, so that exacerbated it, because every time you walked in, you had to walk around a lounging chair or you know, Paul Sullivan or whatever. And the other thing too, and JD could speak to this, I suppose, going back to your pitching days, you have to come up with a different answer to the same freaking question, right? 10 times a week. And that has to get old after a while. And that's why it's amazing managers cannot snap on people.
Yeah, I tried to give the same, as most boring person I could be, I'd say the same exact answers, smile at them, say the same thing, because it's the same question. You're exactly right. And you know, some managers can't. You see that that's when you get the good tirades from the managers and the good snaps and the sound bites. And it's, I don't know if the guys are trying to get that out of you, but I mean, you got to get tired of asking the same question because we definitely get tired of answering it.
Yeah, it's almost a dance that you do because, you know, a lot of times the writers, they know the answer before they ask the question.
Mm-hmm.
They just want to be able to attribute it to you, you know, to the player, because it can't be theirs. It has to come from the source. And that's why I think we all appreciated Joe, because he could play that game so well, and he steered the conversation so many times. Len, how many times were we in his office, or if you're around the scrum when he's dealing with writers before the game, and it would take about 40 minutes before you'd get to a baseball question. We'd be mm-hmm. talking 70s rock and roll and art and just all kinds of wine and everything else before you get around a baseball question. By that time, everybody was like, well, just give us something, Joe. Whatever you say is good by us.
Yeah, and I think the other thing too, Woody, and you kind of alluded to it, and I early in my career in Milwaukee, Paul Molitor, he would show up and do like 5 minutes every day and just like, what do you guys need? And then they left him alone. And so I'm sure some of the advice for players who are being hounded is just get it over with, right? Because if someone really needs you, they're not going to stop until they get your quote. So as difficult as it is sometimes to schedule that time, just kind of being available for 2 or 3 minutes. Okay, good. Boom. You're done.
Yeah. No, you're exactly right. And when you get into that rhythm where you're like, hey, I know what they're wanting. I know the question's going to be, you know, I dealt with injuries a little bit more than most guys. So I had to deal with that stuff, which was not always easy, but you know, it's FaceTime too, right? Like you develop a trust with people when you see them every day. And then, you know, mm-hmm. of course, Sammy was doing what he was doing in 98. So earlier in my career, we would get a flood of people into the clubhouse. You have no idea what outlet they're from, what their angle is, who they are. You've never seen them before. And they all want, you know, throwing microphones in your face. So that got a little bit irritating at times. But Lynn, I got to say, when you first came over to the Cubs, I mean, I saw you in the clubhouse every time it was open. You were down there showing your face, introducing yourself, talking to people. And I think that's what it takes, right? It's building the trust that you're in this with us. You're there. You're traveling with us. You're doing it every day. And you're trying to learn. You're trying to learn guys. You're trying to do your research and your homework. And I think from a player's perspective, you know, we can all complain about reporters, but we all respect the ones that do it the right way and the ones that put their work in and do their homework.
Well, I definitely like to be around the action. Some of it's selfish. I like talking baseball, and, you know, I have a good relationship with John Lester. I don't bother him a lot, but if I need something, I go up and ask him one question and we're done. The other story I can tell is Justin Verlander, when he was still with Detroit, they were at Wrigley Field, and I had read something about how he would occasionally ramp up his velocity and not throw, you know, 96 in the first inning. And so I walked over to their clubhouse and I said, Justin, do you have a second? I have one question. And he laughed and he said, yeah, right. And he goes, go ahead. And so I asked my question. He gave me a really good 3-minute answer. And I said, all right, cool. And he goes, that's it? And I said, that's all I had. I said, yeah. I promised you I had one question. But the one thing I know is that you guys are busy, and I don't ever want to be the guy who every time you talk to him, it's got to be 8 minutes. You know, it's like I can ask Rizzo, hey, you know, yesterday, whatever, you know, blah, blah, blah. Oh, thanks. Go. You know, and the one thing that you tell a young broadcaster, and JD, you can ascribe to this too, is that sometimes you just have to go. You could be in the middle of a deep conversation. It's like, I got to be in a meeting in 1 minute, or I got to go record something. And you have to be able to break it off at any second. And if you're not that kind of person, the clubhouse is probably not your place.
Yeah. Well, and I had one guy too, that, and you don't know who I'm talking about, George Castle. Yeah. Yeah. And we would lock horns, and he would just follow me wherever I was going. I couldn't shake him, but I didn't mind talking to George because he was like a historian to me, you know? So I was learning stuff from him, and it was a daily grind. And we would lock horns, and it was like, I can't shake. And all the other reporters are looking at me like, why are you spending so much time talking to this guy? You're blowing us off left and right. And you're spending, you know, 45 minutes with George every day. And I was like, listen, you know, he's got no angle. He just talks. He's a historian. He wants to tell his stories. And I didn't mind listening to him.
It's really a fascinating place. And if you haven't been in the clubhouse, it is hard to describe sometimes.
Yeah. And everyone is different. You know, I came up with the Yankees and was there just briefly, and that clubhouse was mayhem. There was so much media in there. And then I got traded to the Astros, And there was like two guys. Like there was a beat writer for the Chronicle and a beat writer for the Houston Post, which no longer exists, and maybe a couple other people. But it was so much easier, so much more laid back. And then obviously the situation here with the Cubs is kind of more like what I experienced with the Yankees. Where there's
people in there. I had the same thing. Leaving here and then going to Cleveland, I was like, whoa. You know, it was like there was nobody in Cleveland. It was just a couple of beat writers and, you know, the TV guys, and that was about it. No one was ever coming into Cleveland Clubhouse. And, you know, something to be said about it, I guess. I didn't feel the pressure. I pitched terribly when I was in Cleveland. So, you know, then I got traded to New York and it was a mayhem again and did really well there. So maybe I secretively or not knowingly enjoy it.
You thrived on all that, all the heat. Yeah.
Yeah. And it makes me think of Lou Piniella. I don't know if I've been around anyone who loved that, all the stuff we're talking about, more than Lou. He loved the big stage. He didn't mind controversy. He didn't mind arguments. He had no problem with yelling at people or getting yelled at. And I enjoyed being around him so much. Woody, what was your experience like with Lou?
It was good. Lou's a very smart baseball guy. Obviously, he's been around the game a long time, and when you could get Lou one on one and have real conversations about baseball, you could definitely learn a lot. And he was very knowledgeable about the game. And I had a couple of run-ins with Lou, and one of them was, well, probably both of them were my fault. But there was a game in Pittsburgh. We were up by five and we had gone through the bullpen, and it was just me and Bob Howry sitting down there, and it was getaway day in Cleveland, and we had St. Louis coming up, so I'd already pitched the previous two games in Pittsburgh, so I figured I was going to get this day off. We were up by five, and we were sitting down there, and I'm like, we look at each other, me and Howry, and like, who's it gonna be? And so Howie's like, well, if it's not me, I tell you exactly, I know how much confidence he has in me. And sure enough, like 15 seconds later, the phone rings, get Woody up. And so I'm like, what in the world? Why am I pitching in this game? We've got St. Louis coming in town. I just pitched 2 days. I need a day off. I'm probably going to be pitching in all three of these games in St. Louis that are big games down the stretch. And so I came in, not mentally prepared. I came in, I gave up a hit. I think I balked. I walked a guy. We ended up giving up a run, and we won the game, right? No big deal. We won the game. But I was still kind of upset about being in that game, just kind of thinking ahead. And then I gave up a run because I wasn't mentally prepared to go in. And, you know, that's my fault for not being ready. But so I came in, we shook hands, and I kind of snapped a little through my glove or did something. And I guess Lou saw it, and he called me, and I was in the shower, and then Larry Rothschild comes into the shower, and he's like, hey, Lou wants to see you. I'm like, of course he does. So I throw my towel. I'm in a towel. I throw my towel on. I walk in, and he starts out with, you know, son, what's the problem? What's the bleeping problem? You know, and all year long, we were like, he doesn't know anybody's name. He calls everybody son. So I said, first problem is my name's not son. You can call me Carrie. You can call me Woody. You know, and then he's like, well, son, I go, and then I yell at him, snapped at him again, because he called me son right away, right after that, right? And so then we had it out, and I told him what was going on, and he explained to me that Howard said his shoulder wasn't feeling great, so I gave him an extra day off, and I was like, all right, completely my fault, misunderstood, I'll be ready to go tomorrow. And I walk out of the room, and then I come in the next day, and Larry comes over to him, and he's kind of giggling, and I'm like, what's going on? And he's like, Lou, he was sitting there talking to me. He's like, man, Wood really doesn't like me when I call him son. He's like, snapped at me. So I walk in the next day to kind of re-apologize. And Lou's getting out of the shower. I'm in street clothes. Lou's in, like, he's in a towel. So it still has water. He's soaking wet. I knock on the door. He's like, come on in. I walk in there, and Lou's in a towel. And I was like, Hey boss, I want to apologize. I didn't handle that the right way last night. I'm sorry. I should have done that. We won the game. I did not handle that the right way. I just want to let you know I'm ready to go. Da 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 da. And he's like, come here, son. And he gives me like a big hug. Like he's fresh out of the shower. Towel's probably barely hanging on, and he's bear hugging me. And so I didn't know what to do. So I hugged him back and I left, and I was kind of shaking, and Larry walks by, or Larry was in the office at the time too when that happened. And Larry walks out, and he starts laughing. I'm like, what? I go, that was kind of weird. And he's like, yeah, I got to tell you, the last time I saw a Lou hug a player, it was Rob Dibble. And they were and they had a fist fight after the very next game. So I was like, well, as long as I don't pitch, hopefully we don't get in a fist fight. But Lou was great. We had a couple of run-ins like that. But again, if you talk to him like an adult and handle your business, and he, like you said, he doesn't mind arguments. He doesn't mind ruffling feathers. He doesn't mind having those discussions. But yeah, the fresh out of the shower and wearing a towel Lou hug is always a good story.
You mentioned Larry Rothschild, who is one of my favorite people on the planet. And, you know, and I could tell this to Larry's face. You know, there are people in the game who don't know him, and he carries himself very seriously. And they're like, well, you know, what's Larry like? I'm like, Larry's one of the smartest people I've ever met. He's a Chicago native. He's got a Midwest politeness about him. But if you don't know him, you would never know that. And yeah. You were with Larry for a long, long time. He's still in the game, the pitching coach for the Padres, and another guy who was not afraid to yell at people either.
Yeah. No, and we had a couple run-ins. You were with anybody that long, like, you're going to have a couple run-ins. So me and Larry had a couple too. But I mean, I love Larry. I love him like a dad. He was obviously, you know, instrumental to my career, and mechanically would spend hours and hours just meticulously looking at stuff. And because I wasn't a computer guy, I couldn't go in there and look on a screen and say, hey, this looks like I'm doing this wrong. I had to actually, you know, go out and throw a bullpen and try to adjust it while I was doing it. So I could never really look at film and do that and fix things. So I would tell Larry, something's off, go find it, and then come tell me what it is and let's go fix it. So he was awesome at that. He would spend hours doing it. And sure, I mean, he was never wrong. I mean, he was dead on with, and it wasn't just me. It was, he had 12, 13 guys that he was keeping track of. And Larry was great, but you're right. He's got a great demeanor. You would think he's super quiet and super nice guy and all business. But, that 2000, that staff that we had together and all the way through, actually, with Clement and Pryor and Zambrano, it's just, we tried to get him to loosen up so much and mess with him as much as we possibly could. And he took it like a champ.
We are chatting with Kerry Wood. We will have more after a quick word from our sponsor. Here's to the road ahead. Trust Toyota to be here for you. A Toyota hybrid will give you the confidence to go farther than ever. Enjoy advanced tech in the Camry hybrid. Load up the family in the roomy Highlander hybrid. Or adventure in the RAV4 hybrid, the best hybrid SUV for the money. Right now, get 0% financing on every Toyota hybrid, all from the brand you trust. Today, tomorrow, Toyota. Visit U.S. News Best Cars at cars.usnews.com on 2020 hybrid models. Terms available on approved credit through participating dealers and Toyota Financial Services. Not all customers will qualify. Void where prohibited. Offer ends July 6th, 2020. Speaking of computers and the numbers, I like to ask a lot of retired players. I've asked JD this question, but is there a bit of analytical information or some piece of technology that is prevalent today, Woody, that you would have loved to have 20 years ago?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think that just when I was talking about Larry having to go find out what was going on with my mechanics, right? I mean, I think the stuff these guys have now, like they can, in their bullpen sessions, they can, in spring training or even during the season, they can get feedback. They can turn around and look at the screen after every pitch and kind of see rotation, see spin, see what they did, you know, all that stuff. So I think if I was to have that kind of a device with me, especially during bullpen days or through spring training, I think bad habits would have had a harder time creeping in. You know, I still think it comes down to the way your body feels and health, and if everything's 100% when you go out there, which it rarely is. But, you know, I think to have that instant feedback after you throw a pitch, and when you get a good result, you can turn around and see what it, you know, see what the numbers are. Then you can throw the very same pitch the next time, get a bad result, turn around, look at the numbers and see where it went wrong. And I think to have the ability to do that, you know, pitch to pitch in a bullpen is unbelievable.
And I think there's a lot of information too, you know, video based and also, you know, with all these tracking devices.
Yeah.
Now the angle of the spin on the breaking ball, you know, some pitchers have been convinced, don't throw the slider, throw the curveball. Other guys have been convinced you're throwing your two seamer too much. You need to rely more heavily on your four seamer because you have this unbelievable spin rate, you know. We didn't know what spin rate was.
No.
We knew guys had lively fastballs or, you know, four seamers with hop on it, but there was no way to quantify it. That's, you know, that's been a huge change in the pitching industry.
Yeah. I mean, I would come into spring training every year, that first bullpen, Larry would stand there, and the first year I was dead serious. Like, I came in after, and this was, well, I started in 04. So after a 03 season, really good season, came in 04. And like, I go to throw my first slider and I stop like mid windup and I turn to Larry and I'm like, hey, how did I hold my slider last year? And he just like looked at me so puzzled. Like, are you serious? Like, you've been throwing this for like 3 or 4 years. Like, how do you not know how you grip the slider? I'm like, well, just tell me where I had my fingers, you know? And I was kind of serious because I threw one playing catch and I'm like, that just didn't look right. Didn't feel right. So then I started to throw it off the mound and I'm like, stop midway through. And I'm like, hey, how did I do that again? And so then every year on, I would see like every pitch, you know, the first bullpen of the season, I would say, hey, how did I hold my curveball? What did I do with my, just to kind of mess with him. But like legitimately, I came back 1 year and I was like, that just doesn't feel right in my hand. But to be able to have a machine behind you telling you your spin rate and direction and all the stuff that they have access to would have been nice. Larry would have enjoyed it too, so he would have been less work for him.
You know, JD, we haven't even talked about Texas. We got to dive into Texas, and you guys both know Nolan Ryan. What are your memories of watching him pitch when you were a kid, and what sort of relationship, if any, have you had with the strikeout king?
Yeah, you know, obviously watching him as a kid and just his dominance, just the way he took the game over from pitch one, just and the intimidation that he had on the teams before he even took the mound, I think stood out to me. And just to watch a guy like that go out on the mound and have complete control, even if it wasn't a good day, the hitters were never comfortable. So I enjoyed his approach, his aggressiveness, his the way he challenged guys with his fastball. And you know, over the years, I got to meet him a few times. The relationship didn't continue, but we had a mutual friend that introduced us, and I got a chance to have a couple pretty good conversations, you know, about fastballs and strikeouts and how and when to elevate and things like that early in my career. So, you know, I cherish those conversations.
Have you heard the Oscar Gamble story regarding Nolan?
No.
So the story goes, Alan Ashby told me this one years ago. He was teammates with Oscar with Cleveland, I guess it was. And they're on the team bus and they're riding up to the Big A, and Nolan was such a big deal, they would put him on the marquee, you know, Angels versus Indians tonight, Nolan Ryan pitching. And Oscar's line was, oh boy, 0-for-4 and don't get hit in the head's a good day today.
So that's my point exactly, right?
Yeah.
Oh, that's great.
Well, JD, you can also, you've got a million Nolan stories, but maybe one or two of Nolan's greatest hits for Woody, if you haven't told him.
Well, yeah, I just like Woody said, he had a presence about him. I was college teammates with Tom Browning, who pitched for the Reds, and one time talking with Tommy before a game in Cincinnati, he said to me, you know, I'm watching Nolan and he's strutting around out there like he's a king. And my response was, yeah, that's what he does. But he, you know, that's his mound persona was completely different than his personality, because he was a laid back, you know, just what you expect, Texas rancher, easygoing guy, very kind of humble, small town approach to life. But when he got on the mound, he was a different beast. In 86, in the playoffs against the Mets, in game one, Mike Scott was pitching and Lenny Dykstra started the game with a line drive single up the middle, and Dykstra took a big turnaround first, and he was pumping his fist and, you know, just what was considered showing the other guy up back in the day. It's not a big deal now. And Nolan was sitting there in the dugout watching it all go down. He said, I believe that boy just earned himself a bow tie. And sure enough, game two, very first pitch, he completely undressed Dykstra. I mean, you couldn't throw a better knockdown pitch. I mean, the helmet came off, the bat went flying, and it was just, you know, it was typical Ryan. But in typical Dykstra fashion, he got back in there and hit a rocket to center.
Yeah.
It was really impressive. I mean, nails didn't back down, but Nolan, it was fun to watch him pitch. He was, when I was on that club in Houston, you know how it is, Woody, when you're not pitching, maybe you go up, you have a cup of coffee in the clubhouse early in the game or what. But when Nolan pitched, I never lost the fanboy. I was like, I got to be there for every pitch of this. So I was always made sure I was locked in.
Yeah, well, that and two, you know he's going to hit somebody or at least one. So you got to be down there and be ready. although Ventura took a shot at the old man and it didn't work out well for him.
Yeah. No.
Speaking of strikeouts, you one of the all-time great strikeout pitchers, especially for a starter. What do you make of the game today and just how prevalent strikeouts are?
Yeah, you know, I don't do enough of the analytics, like I said, and I don't follow it a lot. I just, when the games that I do watch and I see the strikeouts going up, you know, and home runs as well, but I think a lot of it is a launch angle, and I think the swings are not as flat. There's not as many, you know, contact guys, base hit bunt guys, and I think, you know, speed seems to be eluding the game a little bit. We don't have base stealers anymore as much, and so I really think it's a pendulum swing. I think it's, you know, like every 7 or 8 years, there's a new pitch. They go from, you know, the split finger is a new pitch to all of a sudden the curveball is coming back now. And then it was a slider for a few years. And so, you know, I don't know if that's going to change in the future. I think that with the analytics, they've got all the numbers. They know exactly what works. And I think, I feel like teams value the 3-run homer more than, you know, a guy with speed or an on base guy. But, I feel like the swings have gotten a little more uppercutty since over the last 10 or so years. But everybody likes a home run. You're going to get strikeouts.
Yeah, and do you watch a game thinking, man, Kerry Wood in his prime, I'd rack up 23 strikeouts in a game.
High fat, and not only that, the high fastball, like they're calling the high strike now. So like we had to work down in the zone, and obviously you did too, JD, but like you never got those calls. You know,
to get a chase up there, you wouldn't get a call.
Yeah, it was only a chase pitch, and now it's like a belt or at the belt or a little bit higher. Like they take that, it's a called strike. So, as far as a 20 strikeout like record, I fully expect that to fall at some point, probably sooner than later.
The only thing about that though is guys generally just don't pitch deep enough into games to even get there, right?
I mean, pitch count.
Yeah, pitch count, you can't walk anybody. There's never been a walk in a 20-strikeout game. And, I don't know how you strike out 20 without throwing 120 pitches.
Yeah. Yeah, I do have that on my side, I guess, for now. The pitch count.
See, somebody will have like 16, and Woody will be on Twitter. They're going to kill this guy. Get him out of the game.
Get him out of there. He's going to blow his arm out.
Exactly. So I have the list of the guys you faced. I'm just curious if you know which – major league hitter you faced more than any other in your career?
Oh, let's see. Probably it's got to be a Cardinal or a Brewer or
It's a guy. Hell, this will give it away. It's a guy you told you didn't like when you became his teammate.
Oh, Jim Edmonds. I was going to say Edmonds. Yeah, I was going to say Edmonds.
Yeah, 51 plate appearances. So Edmonds, Adam Dunn, Albert Pujols, Craig Biggio in the top four. So, yeah, all those guys you faced a bunch. I'm just looking at some of the numbers here. Unlike JD, who struggled against Barry Larkin, Larkin only hit 200 against you. Yeah, I don't know how it felt.
Did okay against Larkin. I felt okay. He was still chasing the high fastball.
Now, Jeff Kent is a different story. I don't know how you felt against him, but, man, oh, man, he, for some reason, had your number.
He killed me. He hit every pitch I threw. I even threw – Mark Clark he threw this little BP sinker. And, halfway through a season, I'm like, man, this Jeff – we're facing the Giants. We were in Candlestick. I'm like, this guy's wearing me out. He's hit slider for a homer. He's hit fastball for a homer. He's hit my changeup. He hits everything. I've hit him in the ribs. He still kills me. He's like, throw him a little BP sinker. I'm like, I've never thrown a sinker in my life. What do you do? How do you do it? So he was like – my little bullpen in between starts, I played around with a couple and thought I saw some movement. So I was like, maybe I'll throw it to Jeff Kent. First pitch, I threw him a little BP sinker, hit it 800 feet. So Jeff Kent wore me out. He obviously saw the ball really well off of me.
Yeah, interesting. There are a lot of really good hitters who did very little against Kerry Wood in their career. It's kind of fun to look at that stuff. So let's hone in on 1998. You're 20, 21 years old. You've got the Sammy Maguire chase. You're trying to establish yourself in the big leagues, 20 strikeout game, that whole deal. I mean, what a whirlwind of a summer, huh?
Yeah, I mean, it really was. It was from getting called up, right? Like you get called up and that's already your whirlwind. And then you know, fifth start, strikeout 20, and I wasn't ready for it. I was just a young kid from Texas, quiet, just wanted to go to work and do my job and stay under the radar as best I could. And I screwed that up in my fifth start. So, you know, I said it a few times too about Sammy and the whole home run chase. You know, they, unbeknownst to him, like he probably saved my whole rookie season just for the fact that he took off and hit 20 homers in June. It just completely took all pressure and spotlight away from me. And I was able to focus more about my, on my job and go out and do what I had to do and work on stuff and try to get better. And so I'm probably more grateful than anybody on that team for Sammy and his season that he did, that he had that year. It just, I really feel like it saved me a lot of the media pressure.
How scary was it when you had to have reconstructive surgery? I mean, you're, as you say, you start your career with such a bang, and then all of a sudden you have to be wondering, am I ever going to do this again?
Yeah, no, it was terrifying. I've never had, you know, I wouldn't even let him give me a flu shot in my right arm. I never had anything. And now all of a sudden I've got a doctor and instruments and all kinds of stuff going on inside my upright elbow. So, you know, it was terrifying for a few months. And honestly, when it became time, you have to learn how to throw again. You have to start at like 40 feet playing catch. And, you know, it's just weird. You haven't thrown a ball in 4 months. You've got new parts in there and, you know, drill holes and all that stuff going on in the elbow. And it's like 4 months into it, you start playing catch. And it was a weird feeling. And you just kind of wonder if you're ever going to get back. But I would say that probably about a week into it, like probably my fifth or sixth time playing catch, I knew that I'd be fine. And it is just going to take time. So I felt confident after I started playing catch and working my way back through the rehab process, you know, for the elbow. But the shoulder, now looking back on it, having gone through shoulder and elbow and other things, but I would do the elbow 10 times before I had to do a shoulder. The shoulder was terrible.
Yeah, you know, kinetics is a real thing and trying to, you know, figure out what mechanics work and don't work. But I don't know how you guys feel about it. The more we know, the less I believe mechanics really have anything to do with injury, and that some guys are just freaks and don't get hurt, and other guys, most guys, eventually will. Even John Smoltz blew out late in his career. And you know, it's funny talking to Smoltz about, you know, what guys should do and shouldn't do. And I remind him all the time, I'm like, you were a freak, man. Tom Seaver and you and Fergie. I mean, I just think sometimes it's luck, the luck of the draw.
Well, I mean, that's why those guys are in the spot they're in, right? They're Hall of Famers, and that's kind of what it takes. But, you know, for mechanics, I always said, and which was hard for me to do because other body parts were hurting, and, you know, back and other things play into it. But good mechanics are whatever you can repeat. Like, your body gets used to that. Mm-hmm. It's when you have something out of the ordinary on a pitch or a few pitches or a start or a couple starts in a row, something changes. That's when we get injured. So, you know, I think as long as you can repeat it, and that's what Glavin and Smoltz and Maddox, those guys, their mechanics were the same from, you know, year one to year 12, like that you could look at them on film and it's identical. You know, I think just being able to repeat your delivery that's your mechanics, and if you can repeat it, your body can handle it.
Yeah, good note.
When Pryor came along, right, that everybody said it's the next Tom Seaver. He's got, you know, these huge calves,
perfect,
big, strong,
perfect mechanics.
Yeah. He'll never get hurt, is what everybody
kiss of death.
Well, yeah. he probably wouldn't have, honestly. I mean, if he's probably the biggest proponent for DH out there, right? Like, if he hadn't been on the bases running and hit Giles, he may still, you know, he may have pitched for another 10, 12 years. You know, when he hit Giles and flipped over and he tore his capsule on that base running play.
Yeah.
And then he went back out and pitched another inning on it with a torn capsule, didn't know it yet. And, you know, when you tear a capsule, that's just not right. Most guys aren't coming back from that. And he worked really hard to get back a few times and got close but you're never the same. So anytime you have any kind of an injury in there, it's you know, it's gonna change your mechanics. No doubt, because you're going to try to your body's going to naturally do what it can to stay away from the pain that it feels when it's doing it. But I think if he wasn't in that collision, he would have had a tremendous career.
Did you ever tinker, you know, through all the injuries? Okay, I'm going to drop my arm angle. I'm going to sink the ball. I'm going to become a different pitcher. Or was that?
Yeah, no, I had to when I went to the bullpen. When I realized I could only throw about 50 or 60 pitches, and then the shoulder would start. You know, start aching again and feel like I was going to have to start over through my rehab process after shoulder surgery. So after I had shoulder surgery, I had to, uh, I had to get more over the top, so I couldn't throw that little slurvy thing anymore, and the curveball wasn't great. But I had to raise my arm angle. I was a little bit more three quarters or a little bit lower as a starter early, and then when I came out of the pen, I was more had to go more over the top because I couldn't get that same angle. So you know, I had to. That's when the cutter came in and a lot more forcing fastballs, and then I could throw the curveball from over the top, but the slider was kind of non-existent.
Of all the great moments you had in your career, and this one, you know, contextually, I suppose, wouldn't be at the top just because you didn't win the game. And this is the thing where I wish guys like you could just kind of remove yourself from your body and just be in the ballpark. But the home run you hit in Game 7 of the NLCS, that's the loudest I've ever heard Wrigley Field. It might be the loudest I've ever heard any ballpark ever, or any NBA arena. I mean, it was complete. Total bedlam, but you probably couldn't enjoy it because you're in the middle of trying to win a ball game. But that was pretty cool.
Yeah, no, I mean, I had chills running around the bases. I just remember sitting on the bench and watching Redmond throw changeup after changeup after changeup, and I'm like, guys, he's just throwing changeups. He can't throw it. You know, he can't throw it past any of us. He's only topping out at like 88, 87 maybe. And but he was throwing this changeup. We were flailing around. So I just committed myself to it. So I went up, cheated first pitch fastball, and fouled it off. And then I was like, all right, I'm sitting changeup the rest of the at bat, and fouled off another fastball just because I was late on it because I was sitting changeup. And then he threw me three changeups in a row and got it to 3-2. And then I was like, all right, well, he's going to throw me a fastball now. And it was just lucky enough he was up in the zone and I caught it. And but running the bases. I knew I tied it up as soon as I hit it. And then I was like, all right, try to not smile or try to not react and just kind of run the bases. And then, like, you know, you get first base and I look towards second base and the bleachers have just erupted and beer and everything's being thrown in the air and people are going crazy. And then my legs got a little wobbly on that one. So I got to second base and just made it in. And I was like, you know, it didn't really get to enjoy it as like you said, but it was kind of like, all right, start over 0-0. We got a chance here. Now we're tied. So go back to work.
So hitting a home run is cooler than striking somebody out, right?
Way cooler. Way cooler.
I would have freaking moonwalked around those bases.
Oh. That's top two moments right there in my career.
Yeah. No, that was something else. You know, hitters don't sit changeup enough. My theory is that most hitters don't like being late on fastballs.
Yeah.
But like, why wouldn't you sit changeup on a guy who's going to throw you one? But they don't.
Right. Again, his changeup was 80, 81 maybe, and his fastball was 86. So it's like 87. It wasn't that big of a differential. I still didn't think he was going to be able to throw fastballs past us. So why not at least pick a couple of pitches? You know you're going to see one.
Exactly.
I guess that speaks to, because you were a very good athlete and a good hitter. But never once in my career when I was pitching did I contemplate for a second what the opposing pitcher was doing. That's pretty interesting. I think that you were that aware of what he was doing where you actually had a game plan. And I couldn't hit a lick, but I'm curious how many other pitchers do that, pay that much attention to the opposing pitcher.
I'll tell you one guy is Jake Arrieta. He said he watched his scouting. He'll look at the scouting report. Lester and Lackey said, I got enough to worry about that they don't. But Jake is very into the hitting part. I know that.
Yeah, I mean, why wouldn't you be? Like, and then, you know, like Zambrano would come in and like he was just a freak. All he had to do was make contact. He was so strong. But I took it seriously. I mean, if you can hit, I mean, it kept me in some games longer than I probably should have stayed in just because of the fact that, you know, Dusty would let me go hit.
Yeah,
and he would green light me first pitch every time, so I got some cheater homers on first pitch fastballs. And when you know it, when you have an idea and you're guessing, when you guess right, you can actually hit it.
So Dusty's managing the Astros, and another iconic, you know, Hall of Fame caliber manager you played for. Any Dusty stories stand out?
Oh man, no, not really. No, I mean, Dusty was great. Like Dusty was, and I told him this on his, I sent him a birthday card and his wife put something together for him for his, dude, it might've been his, I don't know, his 50th or sixth, maybe his 50th birthday. And I recorded a little thing and wrote him a little note. And I said, you'll probably, even I said to this date and probably forever for the rest of my life, like he's the only manager that had a, that had like a team meeting and a pep talk. And he quoted Genghis Khan and Tupac in the same speech.
That's pretty good range.
Yeah. Good range. Dusty was great. I loved playing for him, and I know he catches a lot of crap for his X's and O's, but I think, you know, you can ask anybody that's ever played for him. They absolutely just love playing for him. They'll run through the brick wall for him. They'll do what they can. And I think it speaks volumes to who he is as a person and not just the manager. I mean, he was again, another father figure for me and my wife. We were newly married and trying to have kids. And he was, you know, we had several conversations with him and throughout those times. And he was tremendous for my wife, Sarah, and great for me. And just not baseball stuff, just life stuff. So I love Dusty and you know, it was actually, he reached out to me yesterday for Father's Day. So it was good to hear from him. And I really enjoyed playing for him.
Yeah, he's a good man. And you're right. I've never talked to any player who ever played for him who didn't love him. JD, you got one more for Woody before we let him go?
Yeah, I just wanted to circle back. You had mentioned Texas earlier, Len. I just wanted to go back and just the Kerry Wood experience in high school. You were the fourth overall pick in the draft in 95. I mean, did you lose at all in high school? I mean, Texas high school baseball is really good. But to be 20 years old, striking out 20 guys, you know, 20 very good hitters on that Astros club. So you're, you know, three years removed from high school. I'm just wondering if somebody had faced you in high school and got a hit off you, or if they'd beaten you, the bragging rights they would have with their buddies, like, you know, the scouts must have been all over you.
We had four guys drafted off my high school team my senior year. Two of us signed and went, and the other ones went to college, and one went to Wichita State and the other TCU to play football. But yeah, we had a first rounder, a sixth rounder, a 32nd rounder, and I'm not sure what round the last guy went in. But so we had a good team, and there was, you know, we had 30 scouts every night, you know, cross checkers and everybody at every game. So my buddy, best friend growing up, he was the other left-handed pitcher. He pitched Tuesday nights and I pitched Friday nights, and you know, that was it. We didn't really have anybody else. We had one other guy that would throw if we had a tournament or we had weekend games or something like that. But he was a Tuesday night. I was Friday night. And I gave up some hits. Didn't lose. I was 11-0, I think, that year, and gave up a couple of hits. And but I mean, the year before that, I was just another guy that couldn't pitch. You know, I wasn't a hard thrower, and I grew 6 inches between my sophomore and junior year. And my junior year, I pitched a little bit, but we still had my coach at the other school I was at had a senior ahead of me, so he was big on letting the seniors lead the team, and so I was like the third or fourth pitcher, and then most of my recognition and most of my work was done in the summer leagues in Texas, and again, it's tremendous competition. Your scouts are at all those games, so you know, really, the first time I was seen by a scout was my sophomore year, and I was the only reason they saw me was because I was facing, they were there to see Ben Grieve. And so all the scouts were there for Ben, and I pitched well against him. He did take me deep, but I got hosed on the call before. So, but Ben was a stud. And so I really kind of lucked out. It was just my day to throw. My coach put me in there, and it was my day to pitch. And I got a chance to face Ben when all the scouts were there. So I think kind of put me on the radar a little bit.
All right. Last question. Your best friend in the game, is there one or two maybe guys you played with, against, who to this day you would consider a brother in arms, so to speak?
Yeah, you know, I still reach out to John Lieber, and obviously I'm in contact with Pryor and Clement. And, you know, early in my career, I was really, really close with Jason Bure. He took me under his wing, and we had some good times together and the families, and we would travel in the offseason and see those guys. And life happens, and it's just been too long in between, and we still keep in contact a little bit, but not like we did. But I would say probably throughout baseball, he was probably one of the guys I was the closest with, and John Lieber's great. I still obviously see him during Cubs convention week, and you know, we check in with each other, and there's a handful of guys we still kind of check in with and keep in contact, and the wives are all friends. And I'm not a Facebook guy, so I'm not on social media much, so I don't keep track of most guys. Like my wife keeps in contact with most of the wives, so she'll tell me, hey, you need to call Matt, or you need to call you know, Jason and talk to those guys.
Yeah, Matt Clement, another beautiful human being. Love that guy.
Great.
Woody, thanks so much for the time. We'll do this again. We'll dive into some other stuff, but really great information, and we'll see you at the ballpark hopefully soon.
Let's hope so. Great talking to you guys.
Thanks, Gary.
Great stuff from Kerry Wood. I love the Lou Piniella stories, and I'm sure he could have told more. Woody had a lot of fire. There were moments when, you know, he would fire his glove into the stands after a rough outing, but he was a fierce competitor. There's something about those Texas-born pitchers, huh?
Yeah, he's part of that that lineage, right, with Ryan and Clemens and Kerry Wood. And I guess Josh Beckett came on a couple of years.
John Lackey.
And a big, tall. They're all big and right-handed. And yeah, you're right. Kerry had that competitive fire. And I think some of that probably fueled by the frustration, too, of all the injuries that he had to overcome. But yeah, you know, come for the 20 strikeouts, stay for the Lou Piniella stories. That stuff is beautiful.
Exactly.
When he's calling him son, and just good stuff.
So it looks like we're going to play baseball, and I'm thrilled about it. And if everything lines up the way everybody wants it to, it's going to be quite the sprint.
Yeah, it's going to be very interesting. It should be a lot of fun. You know, everybody wants to discuss the legitimacy of this and what's it going to be like to crown a champion. And frankly, at this point, I don't care. I just want to see a bunch of humans running around out there in Major League uniforms playing ball. So let's go. I'm fired up.
All right. So for this week's admission, do you have anything in particular? I'm searching for one.
Well, I guess, talking pop culture, I don't know that this makes me unique, but I have never seen a single episode of The Wire.
Mm.
Maybe one episode of Breaking Bad, but I don't think so. And about half The Sopranos. So these great programs in TV history, I haven't really checked in on. So I've asked you for your recommendation. If I was going to pick one of those, which should I watch?
To me, it's The Wire. I think it's the best show ever made. I think it's incredibly realistic. And for me, it would be The Wire.
I'm in.
But you have to, the first episode, there's a lot there and it doesn't make a lot of sense. And you've got to stick with it. There is a payoff, but you got to keep watching, okay? Because I think what happens is you watch a pilot and you decide based on 50 minutes whether you like a show or not. But stick with that one. And the other cool thing about those types of shows that are now 20 years old is you go, oh, that I know her. She was in this show. And, you know, all of these actors went on to other big performances in movies and the like. So I think you'll enjoy it. I guess I'll stick to baseball, and with all the rules possibilities, and at the time of this recording, nothing is necessarily firm. Not a big fan of the idea of a runner at second base to start extra innings, and I think I mentioned this a few weeks ago. Like the 12-inning tie is something I would be totally fine with. I actually looked it up in 1876 at the dawn of the National League. A month and 3 days into Major League Baseball history, Louisville and Philadelphia played to a 2-2 tie. So you might not like the idea of a tie. And obviously back then it had to do with probably the fact it got dark and they didn't have lights. In terms of the essence of the game, a tie would be part of the essence if it occurred in 1876, right?
Yeah, they used to, sometimes it was based on the train schedule too. They had to catch a train. So the game would end. It'd be, you know, can't afford to play one more inning. Time to go.
Yep. Well, a special thanks to Max Berman, Joe Rios, Matt Romito, Daniel Green, Jim Obojkovic, Shane McGuire, Adam Sobel, for JD. I'm Len. Make sure you subscribe, rate, and review, and share this podcast with your friends. We will talk to you next week with a couple of great baseball authors, Brad Baloukjian and Dan Epstein. It's Open Concessions presented by Toyota.